Welcome to Innovation Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we've got repeat guest Brent Thompson, but it's been about 7 years, so I figure we're due for an update. Brent, founder of Jive, founder of Blip Billboards. What else am I missing for some career highlights?
Graduating class of 12 students in Escalante High School. That's one of the highlights.
Well, let's do this. Let's talk. Why don't you give us a little bit of the Jive life cycle, and then let's jump into Blip.
Okay. To understand the Jive setup, you kind of have to understand the setup. I started my first company accidentally. I was a sophomore in college. I was studying electrical engineering at the time, but it overlaps a lot with computer science. I learned to code. I could code, and people wanted code written, so they started paying me, and before I knew it, I had this little business. And it was just a crummy little software engineering firm. It's okay as a business model. I wasn't cut out for it, I would say, but it did okay. One of our customers was a river rafting outfitter. We wound up building a website and then a booking system. And then finally, after a few years, it grew into just a full-on ERP system for river rafting outfitters. We came to find out they were the second biggest outfitter in the country, and they were state-of-the-art the way they were doing it previously, which was 100% paper. And so together with them, we spun that out, packaged it up, and started selling it to other river rafting outfitters. They eventually bought us out of that, and which effectively bought us out of the engineering firm as well. Most of our man hours were spent on that project by then. Running that, though, we had reached the point where we had maybe 15 employees. We needed a phone system, and I went and started shopping for those. We need to be able to just basic stuff, transfer calls and put people on hold and have multiple lines so that our customers didn't just get busy signal and that kind of stuff. It was going to be crazy expensive to get like one of these official phone systems that you put in your office closet with enough handsets for everybody. It was like 30 grand or something like that, if I remember right. And I was just a cheapskate. I wasn't going to pay 30 grand for phones. So I downloaded some open source software. I installed it on a retired workstation. We spent maybe 2 grand on the actual phones. And I had this phone system that I just built. I configured the software and the thing worked. And then when we sold the software and river rafting outfitter software companies, I had a couple of the guys that worked for me. And I had this phone system that I had built. And we just started selling those. And that was, what, 2006? And I was the CEO there until 2011. And then I kind of retired.
And then what did Jive ultimately sell for in the end?
So private equity came in right after I sort of retired. I got out a little bit at that point. And then a publicly traded company bought it in 2018 for $357 million.
So from startup to the $357 million, how many years was that?
So that was 6 through 18, so 12 years.
And and I know a little bit of the story, but let's go through for everyone else. So you retired from Jive, you're sitting around, and you're annoyed with another industry. Talk about Blip.
Annoyed is harsh. I am an annoyed person inherently. You'll come to realize that if you listen to me long enough. Like I'm a ranter. I get pissed off a lot. But billboards, I was more just curious. I had this buddy who was doing work for Yesco, the Young Electric Sign Company here in Salt Lake City, who's a significant billboard operator. We were mountain biking actually, and I just made some comments about how I'd seen these billboards starting to be converted into digital screens. Like the old vinyl printed stuff was getting torn down and they were putting up these digital screens. And I made some assumption and some sideways comment about, oh, that's got to just be a computer on a stick. And he's like, yeah, that's exactly what that is. And then I made a second assumption, which was completely wrong. And that second assumption was, well, if it's a computerized ad network, then they've got to just be doing like a marketplace, like Google or Facebook or one of these, where you have a bunch of people offering money to get in front of an audience. And then the computer figures out who's going to pay the most for what time and how to allocate and optimizes for everyone. You get maximum visibility for the advertisers and maximum revenue for the sign owners. And my buddy just kind of chuckled, said, no. That's really cute. But let me tell you how it really works. If you want to show up on one of these digital screens, you're going to have to fax them a contract. They're going to run a credit check. You're going to need to commit to like 6 months, and it's going to be like 50 grand to show up one time, and before you show up the first time. And I mean, insert your cliche here, my mind was blown, right? Like, I'm this computer guy. I see the world through a computerized lens. And it just was baffling to me that I had to commit to a traditional billboard contract, basically, in order to show up on a computerized ad network. And it just seemed ridiculous to me. And honestly, it seemed so obvious that that's how it should be done that he and I both assumed there was some fundamental reason that it couldn't be, and we just let it go. And maybe 6 months later, I still hadn't found anyone who would sell me like a one-day contract, and I hadn't found any reason why, like there were no laws that said you couldn't. And so I called him up and said, hey, like my brain won't leave this alone. I need to know what the answer is. Why can't this be done? And so you have friends over there. Will you call them? And like let's just go talk to them. They'll tell us why this can't be done, and I can move on to something else. So he sets up this meeting with Pat, who's the president of the outdoor division at Yesco. And Pat's exactly who you expect him to be. He's like, I don't know, at the time, maybe 60 years old. He's been slinging billboards his whole life. Like when he was a kid, his dad was in the industry. He started out painting plywood for billboards that they would hang on the side of the freeway. Like his whole life has been dedicated to this. And he's also Mr. Billboard. Like everyone in the industry knows him. He's on all like the trade group boards of directors, and like everybody knows Pat. And so it's these two relatively young guys that show up, and we're explaining how Facebook works and how Google works. And he's got this notion of an ad network and a two-sided marketplace. And after that, we just asked so there's like why can't that be done for billboards? And you know, Pat, he just shrugged, he pounded his fist on the table and said, I don't know, maybe nobody's thought of it. That's the future though. Let's go do it. And we're just sitting there astounded. Like he's supposed to tell us the problem with our thinking here, like why can't this be done? And he's like, oh, let's go do it. And so we had our first customer. We went home and started writing code. And that was probably November of 15. And in June of 16, we launched on all of Yesco's inventory. They had 4 states worth of inventory in the Rocky Mountain region. And we launched in June. We only served Yesco for the first year. At about the year mark, we had figured out how to run the business around it, how to, you know, get the ads out to the signs, get the proof of play back, how to build the credit cards for the advertisers, all of that. And we started going and attracting other sign owners across the country. Now we've got inventory in every state. We've got, you know, I don't know, 350 companies like Yesco that give us a nationwide footprint. We don't own any of the inventory. If we did, we'd have the second largest footprint of inventory in the country at this point. So it is large. It's going to be a thing.
So how many signs do you think you're on across the country?
Digital is about 2,500. Static, the vinyls. We can also sell the vinyls that our media owner partners own. There's probably 50 or 60,000 that are in our footprint.
So explain to people just how cheap they can start running billboard experiments and like how easy this is to start.
Well, you tell me, how much would you think it costs? So here in Utah, where we both are, we've got I-15 and I-80. That's sort of the high traffic mark for the state of Utah, right? We call it the spaghetti bowl because it's exactly like you see on movies and stuff, right? So there are a couple of signs right there. How much would you expect? So the ads run for 8 seconds. How much would you expect an 8-second play costs right there?
Well, it's not fair because I know that you have like right on the website, try your first experiment for $10.
Yeah.
And it's like, sometimes it's only cents per blip.
Yeah. Yeah. So $10 is an overestimate. We put that on there, just giving people some idea. Like you don't want to run one ad one time. That's not going to be terribly effective as an ad campaign. What you really want to do is a lot like you do online. You just want to set a daily budget and you set your target, you know, signs, your target audience effectively, and then just let it run. So the price question, it depends on the sign and the time of day. So, you know, that one at rush hour might be 40 cents every time your ad shows. The same sign at 2 a.m. might be a nickel. So it'll vary roughly by the traffic that people anticipate are going past there. It's just supply and demand. There are lots of people who want to advertise on that sign during the day when there's lots of cars, and a lot fewer advertisers vying for the space at 2 a.m. Tell you what though, if you're targeting truck drivers, you're like, you're a truck stop, man, you get some cheap advertising that targets those guys that are on the road at night.
That's great. And I saw some crazy numbers. I don't know if they're updated, of like how many customers you guys have had now.
So accounts created almost 300,000. We have a very, you know, standard, I would say, funnel shape, you know, maybe 10% of those spend money So, you know, we have, we'll have a 10% conversion ratio on that. But free accounts, you know, almost 300,000.
So, and so let's arguably call it 30,000 paying customers, roughly. And do you guys, do you guys share what your valuation is or anything like that at Blip? Okay.
We don't, so, no.
Well, we'll use Jive for fun then. You know, there's so many both fund managers and like founder CEOs who listen to the show, and they really love, you know, the stories I hear back are like, man, I loved hearing how they did it, and then also how they survived like the terrible times. So why don't we start with what's a $357 million success secret?
Do everything manually first. So people like to throw around terms like fake it till you make it, and nail it and scale it, and minimum viable product, and they are overestimating every one of those things. I'm a software guy. I mean, this is me, the software guy, saying that the MVP is almost never software. So I have a joke, and you know, if you've ever worked for me, I apologize for beating you over the head once more with the same joke. But I joke that there's this thing called service as a software, where, you know, you do it with manila envelopes on your desk, shuffling stuff around and talking to people on the phone rather than writing software. And this isn't what gets you from, you know, 10 million to 357 million. This is what gets you from zero to 10. And that's the hardest part, though. If you can get from zero to 10, the rest is just extrapolation. But yeah, go like figure out what the actual minimum viable product is. And I guarantee it is way less than you think it is. It's going to be one feature, literally one feature to one customer. And you don't have to write a line of code to deliver that. You just need to find what you can deliver a value to them. Have a plan for how you're going to go about building the software that automates it and drives down your internal cost structure, sure. But for the first one, you like honestly, you have no idea what you should build, what people are going to find valuable, how much you should charge for it, until you've actually done it manually a few times. Once you've done that, you're going to live and breathe that product and be intimately familiar with that customer. And then you're going to be able to go and build something efficiently. You're not going to overbuild. You're not going to build the wrong thing and have to retool. You're going to know by then what you should have to build because you've been doing it manually every step of the way up until then.
Why do you think that it is uncommon advice to recommend a founder team builds everything manually before getting into the tech stack?
How much do you like to clean toilets?
Not a huge fan. I'm going to tell you it out there.
No. Most, you know, going and shuffling manila folders around on your desk is not sexy, right? People want to build the software thing. They want to go raise money. And to raise money, you've got to have this novel thing that gives you this awesome competitive advantage and drives down your cost. All that's like, no. Like, sure, that stuff's all going to be necessary, but the first thing you have to do is figure out how to deliver value to somebody. And if you insert a layer of software between you and your customer before you've ever talked to your customer, all you're doing is decreasing the likelihood that you're actually going to latch on to what's valuable to them, you know, and be able to deliver it to them.
Yeah, I love them.
So it's the manual labor. It's going and shoveling rocks for a few weeks before getting behind the, you know, the wheel of an end load, you know, a front end load.
Yeah. What's another principle that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars in your mind?
Let me think. I'm going to pause here for an awkward pause. I actually have a list of these, so I'm going to pull that up.
Sound effects. I like that. How many on the list? Silence. I'm intrigued here.
A few. This one is not going to make people feel good, but it is absolutely true. By the way, I have a process that I go through when people ask me to speak occasionally. It's not terribly often, but occasionally they do. And I go through the same process, which is like, what should I talk about? And the most potent setup for what a person should talk about in those situations is something that is, you know, you want to deliver something true and something that's like unknown, something that's novel to people. Otherwise, what's the point? And so that was my takeaway for a couple of years worth of giving talks. And then I realized, like, well, if it's something they don't know, even more potent than that would be something that's the opposite of something they believe, which is still also true, though. And that's what I'm about to drop on you. People give way too much credit to hustle and cleverness and education and all that crap. And it is just, it's not pure crap, but it's 99% crap compared to the real differentiator in like startup success. I'm a storyteller. Forgive me for like telling this in a, framing it as one more story. You know who Usain Bolt is, right? Right. So world's fastest man. What else do you know about Usain Bolt? He's what, Jamaican or something like that. He's also like 6'7" and best sprinter in the history of sprinting. And I have played a lot of basketball. I don't think he has. In my life, I've played thousands of hours of basketball. My guess is that if he took up basketball within maybe 6 weeks, he would beat me 10 times out of 10. Why is that?
Size advantage, endurance.
He's 6'7" and one of the greatest athletes in the history of the world. Right? Like there is no overcoming that. I have years of coached experience, right? I have honed my craft as far as I can, but at the end of the day, I'm 6 feet tall and I'm not, I don't have his build, I don't have his physique, I don't have his genetics, is what I'm getting at. And the same thing applies. There are two factors that are overwhelmingly going to determine your success as a startup founder. It is genetics and background, like upbringing. If you were born into abject poverty, you're probably not going to be a successful entrepreneur. If you were born into affluence, you're probably not going to be a successful entrepreneur. There's a group called the Kauffman Foundation that studies and promotes entrepreneurship. They issued a paper, they published a paper that described the commonalities in the background of these top-tier successful startup founders. And it was be a second child, be very smart, be well above average intelligence. In fact, they quantified it. They said, be in the top 10% of your high school graduating class. But then it got interesting. Only be in the top 30% of your college class, though. I think part of that is related to, they also said, don't be poor, but don't be even a little bit rich. If you can dive into any one of these things and figure out why that is, why that makes you less likely to be a successful entrepreneur. If you're wealthy, the opportunity cost is too high. Entrepreneurial success is actually pretty rare and generally not terribly large scale. And if you come from wealth, you should follow the conservative route. You should go to a top-tier university, go get a top-tier job at a top-tier, company. That's the way to mathematically, statistically, optimize for career trajectory and wealth and power and all that crap that's probably important. But if you grow up as a second child from a very middle-class family, I also came from a tiny little town, like I started out by describing, like we had to do everything for ourselves. That wasn't a family mantra, that was reality. Like there were 800 people there and you just had to get by. So there was very much this like pioneer spirit there where it was do it yourself, get it done. Nobody else is going to do it for you. There was also this really strong distrust of authority figures there because all policy came from outside. And in particular, land use policy was all intended, 100% of the time, it was intended to take the land from the people who currently occupied it, which was, the locals, the farmers, the ranchers, the loggers, the indigenous Native Americans, all of that stuff. Every time there was a change in land use policy, without exception, it was to take the land from the people who currently occupied it. And so there was this inherent distrust of outside authority, outside power. And that is honestly, I mean, to be a startup founder, you have to at least be ambivalent about outside authority and power, right? I mean, entrepreneurship is inherently anti-incumbent. It is absolutely anti-incumbent. There's no way around it. You have to threaten some existing infrastructure to exist as a founder. And it sure is helpful if you see the world that way because that's how you were born. So anyway, that would be my, long answer to your relatively simple question, which is, what, turns the probabilities of success in your favor. It's things that you can't control. Sorry to say that, but it's stuff that you can't control. You need to be, above average intelligence and have a background that makes you predisposed to see the world in a certain way, which makes you likely to be a founder. And
And, you know, obviously statistics can be beat, right? And there's outliers and everything.
Oh, for sure. But statistically, you're not the exception.
Yeah. I want to dive into this a little bit more. I want to find out what's on this list. Let's keep going down the list.
Okay. So I am an idea guy. Like, I have lots of ideas. Lots of people have asked, like, where does this come from? Like, how do you keep generating these ideas? And I don't have an answer. It's not something I actively do. It's not even something I do because it feels good or it gives me satisfaction. It's honestly, it's just a neurosis. It's something that I can't stop. I can't not do. My neurosis happens to be deemed valuable today for whatever reasons. And so it's been popular and, you know, beneficial financially for me over my career. But it doesn't feel like it's that different from any other neurosis that I've heard people describe about, you know, their own personal life or that I've seen depicted in TV shows or anything like that. It's just a different flavor of neurosis. Having that light version of OCD, certainly helps. Like that is one of the driving characteristics. If you look at people like Elon Musk or, you know, Jeff Bezos or any of these sort of top tier, ultra high profile, like, you look at all of them and they're broken. There is something broken about those people. Like they are atypical in some way. That extreme capability comes at a cost. Like, there is some compromise. And that's one of the things that certainly leads to entrepreneurial success is that you have, you know, this thing you can't turn off. You actually can't ever satisfy it. It's just this neurotic impulse that you can't leave alone.
Let's talk about that because, you know, at Jive, private equity comes in, you're able to retire as a CEO.
It was uglier than that, but yeah, I made out okay. And got to retire.
I appreciate the honesty. But let's talk about this. Like, what does that look like for you? Like, I know for me, I have like major shiny penny syndrome. Like, I want to do everything, you know? And then
I find out I do too.
The less things I do, the more money I make. But it's not that I don't want to do them all, and I want to do them all now.
Yeah, so I'm interested in everything. Earlier today, I got certified as a forklift operator. That's interesting. So when I stepped away from Jive, I spent the next 6 weeks literally playing video games. You heard my ringtone a second ago, like old school 8-bit Nintendo, right? Like that was my life for 6 weeks. I sat in front of the TV with a controller in my hands. An illustration of how obsessive I am. That kind of, you know, went away, and I started working on stuff again. Like I had all these ideas, I had free time, and I just started doing them. I helped a couple different friends with companies they were trying to start. It was only 4 years. 2011 till 15 when Blip kind of spun up. And so for, I guess, 4 years, I had recently gotten married when I retired. And then, we started having kids and traveled a little bit and tinkered around with a couple different things. And then Blip kind of sucked me in and everybody else along with it.
Okay, I want to hear what else is on this list.
I have a very unique concept of good and evil. I've distilled it down. I have this great unifying theory of good and evil. Unifying theory is morality, trying to reconcile all forms of philosophy and moral discussions and ethics that have ever come before for the hundreds of thousands of years that humans have been communicating with each other. My notion of good is efficient. I'm not full of myself enough to assert that that is absolute truth. It's just that that's how I'm wired. If something is efficient, it is better than something that is inefficient. And if there is a person or a power that is holding on to inefficiency because it benefits them, that is immoral in my view. Not because I've, you know, arrived at that through some philosophical introspection. That's, like I said, that's just how I'm wired. I don't think that's unique to me, though. I think if you go talk to any engineer worth their salt, there's a heavy dose of that. Like they are in the same boat. Efficient is simply better. And if you stretch hard enough, you can fit everything into that mold. Fitting everything through that mold makes it easy for me to jump into a crusade on something like a startup, right? So if I see a more efficient way, for example, to sell billboard space, I can very quickly turn a field that I don't really know anything about or care about per se into something that I am passionate about, because it becomes a crusade. It becomes a moral crusade. Efficient is better. Efficient is moral, and inefficient is immoral. And I'm going to crush that. And so that's one of the things that has certainly led me. And by the way, when you say like what leads to success, I'm not silly enough to project what has led me to success onto everyone else universally. But this is certainly one of my characteristics that has led me to success, is that I can get into whatever feels good and righteous to me, or try to squash whatever feels immoral. And again, my version of good and evil is a very convenient one given today's value allocation in the market. So
what's a practical example of how that shows up now that you've built Blip and it's 30,000 plus customers or things like that? How does that show up? Like I make sense in how the business got started in the first place. How does that show up day to day in your continuous improvement or something like that?
Yeah, so we've actually developed a handful of it sounds cliche, but like value statements, like company values, that kind of stuff. One of those is that we deliver value. Like we insist on delivering value. And generally, if you're increasing the total value of a system, you're also increasing the efficiency. The inputs are generally going to be roughly the same over time. If you distill it all the way down, I mean, there's a certain amount of radiation hitting the earth from the sun every day. And that is the energy that drives all of behavior of everything. And so for more value to be produced, it requires higher degree of efficiency. So one of our core principles is efficiency vis-a-vis value generation. We strive to maximize value generation. We are also in it for the long haul. We focus on relationships over transactions and long-term over short-term. Again, it's the notion of value, but in this case, compounding over time. If you're going for long-term value, you can generate more value. You just can, if you're willing to patiently build over time.
So what's an example of something you fixed last year or that the team identified last year looking through this lens?
In the last year.
Or last year or two, I don't know, sometime recently, like well into the business.
Well, the existence of the marketplace, the genesis of the company was a huge, economically efficient leap forward. Here's a good one from the last year. We've been struggling with the same problem as the industry. The industry's been struggling with it for 100 years. We've been struggling with it for 8. The issue is, what does a billboard actually do? How do you quantify, like if I put my ads on a billboard, what do I get for it? Like, how do I quantify that? Attribution is really hard. But without understanding what it is that you get for it, you can't really understand how you could use the medium. I think there are probably some very sophisticated advertisers that do a really good job with billboards, but they don't share how they do that good job. They just use that for their own competitive advantage internally. And so one of the things that we've done is try to dive into, like, what is a billboard actually doing to an audience, so that we can then optimize, i.e. make more efficient, that process of delivering whatever that value is. What we've concluded is that a billboard delivers repeat impressions to an audience. So the same person, for example, is shown the same ad multiple times over a period of time. If you're advertising frequently enough, your message will be lodged in their brain kind of consistently over a long enough period of time that their brain will start to treat that as authoritative. That's the goal of the billboard, is to place a message, a suggestion, authoritatively in the mind of a user. Now, the part about efficiency and therefore morality, ethics, value, whatever, is that there is a sweet spot. If you're only showing your ad to a person, say, once every 10 years, it's probably not doing a dang thing. You're going to still spend some form of money on that, but you're not going to get anything for it. Like, to me, that's immoral. You are paying something and getting nothing. On the other extreme, though, the same thing happens. If you're filling the same ad to the same person every 30 seconds, 24/7, for months at a time, like, you're overexposing by a lot. You're paying way too much to get that sort of saturation. and the you know the marginal value that you're receiving beyond a certain point drops off precipitously. So what we've calculated is that you need to be showing your ad to an individual roughly 6 times every 90 days is what you should be going for. So that you're consistently present once every week or two, they're seeing your ad. And that will, in their brain, you will be consistently present. That concept will be there to the point that it just starts becoming reality. And so if you are only getting one impression, say, per 90 days, or if you're getting 20 impressions per 90 days, those are both incredibly inefficient uses of your billboard budget. You should be shooting for 6 repeat impressions per person per 90 days.
What's another billboard best practice?
Don't put your face on a billboard. Okay. Like, unless you are like a card carrying professional model, do not put your face on a billboard. If I even get into which industries are renowned for doing that, it's going to get too personal.
But just tell me more about the principle behind it.
You are not as good looking as you think you are. You don't hold a candle to the actual professional, like actors and models. If your only competitive advantage in your business is who you are, not what you deliver of value, then you need to retool something else in your business rather than, you know, making it personal, trying to get people to feel some affinity for you, the human being. You need to deliver some form of value rather than being the person that they're transacting with. You need to just deliver value. The other best practices I would say are use fewer words than you think. Do not put your business card on a billboard. The general guidelines are like 5 words or less. 5 is certainly an upper bound. Like if you can get it, the fewer the words, the better.
Kind of like YouTube thumbnails.
Bigger font. Yeah. It's actually a very parallel. The font sizes need to be bigger than you expect. The contrast needs to be higher. And for heaven's sake, if you're selling a visual product, put a picture of the product up there. I have a friend, you know him, he sells churros. And it's like, oh my gosh, put a picture of the churro on a billboard, your phone is going to ring, right? Like that is, a product like that is a gift from God. You should just put the picture of a steaming churro on the billboard and let people call you.
Any other design tips or philosophical tips for folks considering a digital billboard?
Let's see. I mean, if you want like an in-depth breakdown of the design do's and don'ts, just go to our website, litbillboards.com. There's a whole bunch of guidelines for the artistic side of stuff. I would say philosophically, understand that it is a different medium than online advertising, for example. If you've ever done any sort of marketing, you've probably run into this concept of a marketing funnel, you know, where it's wider at the top and narrower at the bottom. Anything clickable is at the very bottom of the funnel, right? Like you're asking someone to transact right now. Anything that isn't clickable is not at the bottom of the funnel. So don't treat it like it is. Billboards, television, radio, these are all audience-based. They're not one-on-one. You don't know the identity of the person. There is no ability to transact real time. Someone can't, you know, buy now as they're driving past your billboard at 80 miles an hour. It's not going to work. They can't even sign up for your mailing list, you know, going past the billboard at 80 miles an hour. You can't put a QR code on there. We'll simply reject it because it's not safe for somebody to pull out their phone and try to scan the thing while they're cruising past. But best practices, don't expect billboards to act like online advertising. They are a different medium, higher up the funnel. They should flow into your bottom of funnel advertising. You should have a comprehensive strategy that includes all segments of that funnel. Billboards are going to be far cheaper in CPM terms than online advertising, but they're also going to be higher latency. However, if you get into the math, if anyone out there knows what a discount rate is, billboards are a fantastic investment if you view through the lens of discount rate. Your latency online is basically zero. It's a couple of seconds. So you put your dollar into Google and you get your dollar two out like 10 seconds later. Billboards, the CPMs are a fraction of what they are online, but the latency might be 6 months. However, the discount, the effective discount rate over a 6-month period is probably like 60%, you are not going to find better investments for your business than something that carries a 60% discount by waiting only 6 months for that thing to pay off. So, I mean, that's an effective like growth rate of like 120%. So fantastic medium. If you use it right, you anticipate the latency, you use it to set up transactional advertising lower down in your funnel. Don't expect it to be transactional.
Yeah. Well, maybe to finish off here, I know we're about out of time. What's one tip for, you know, founders, business owners, people in the single digit millions trying to get to the tens of millions, with a hopeful to the hundreds of millions eventually, but that jump from single digit millions to double digit millions.
So the jump from singles to tens, it's really pretty linear. You can still brute force a lot of stuff at that scale. To get from tens to hundreds, you've got to automate everything. You've got to have a sales process that's just humming. You've got to have operations just humming. Finance has to be humming. HR has to be humming. You can scale pretty linearly from one to 10. So maybe what I'll twist your question a little bit and answer it slightly differently. And that is, what are the things that you need to do between 1 and 10 so that you're in a good spot to get to 100 after that? I'm actually going to reframe it again, like things that I've screwed up in the past, like things that I should have done differently. Start thinking about culture as soon as you have people in. Like as soon as you start bringing, like, you should have you and a founder, first of all. Like there should only be two co-founders. That is the right number. There is not another number that is appropriate. Two. Second, as soon as you have another person there who is not a founder, they can have a big chunk of stock, sure, but they're just an employee. Even if you're paying them with all stock, they're still just an employee. That's a different philosophical rant for a different day. But as soon as you have that third person there, start thinking about culture. In the early days, your company is going to inherit your personality, your and your co-founder's personality. By the time you get to maybe five total people, you're not going to be able to rely on simply osmosis to spread your personal personality throughout the company. You're going to have to start being thoughtful and strategic. Like, what do we want the culture to be? Now, does every move we make reinforce the culture we're trying to set up? Does every hire we bring in take us a step closer to that ideal culture or a step farther away? So have that conscious conversation, probably with your co-founder, maybe with yourself, but figure out what is the culture going to be, the ideal culture, and then screen everything through that lens. Another thing I've screwed up, I would say, is having professional finance skill. I can hack it. I can brute force it. I'm good with math. But there is a big difference between, you know, being an engineer and being able to do calculus and having a sense of how the American monetary system works in a way that lets you be financially prudent with a lot of stuff. The hard part, you know, spoiler, the hard part is not the math or the numbers. The hard part is human nature. It's understanding what the humans want that you now employ, and what the government wants that now like oversees you from a regulatory standpoint, and like all of that stuff. If that is your personal area of like personal competitive advantage, you had better be starting a company in like the tax prep business or something like that. And if it's not your area of personal capability, you should hire that or outsource that. You should not take that on yourself. Same goes for legal. Just you know, search and replace finance for legal, and that whole, you know, speech still applies there. You should build a product and serve a customer that you have a specific connection to, you have a unique advantage in, and the vast majority of founders are not accountants, FP&A people, or lawyers. I know people from all three of those who are quite successful as founders, but they are outliers.
I love it. Well, anything you want to leave people with as we close off here?
I think that more people should be founders. I think that more people should work for small companies. You heard me sort of, you know, get on my high horse about, you know, anti-incumbents and, you know, all of this stuff. Like, incumbents are a big, big problem. They're a problem politically. They're a problem commercially. They're a problem educationally. They are anti-efficient. Incumbents use their position to reinforce that position and to extract greater advantage from that position over time. You've heard the phrase, you know, power corrupts. That's exactly what that means. When you have power, you can extract more value for yourself having less merit. And so like everyone should consider, and far more people should, either go work for a small company or go start your own thing.
Yeah, I do think about this like with Disney, you know, like Steamboat Willie becomes Mickey Mouse, and then they use all these profits to make sure nobody can do it to them and to change the legal laws around intellectual property so that the advantages that Disney came out of, no one else can enjoy. And that's a tough
exactly
one
right.
for me.
That's exactly right. So Disney, first of all, like given the regulatory structure around them, they have done a fantastic job of returning value to owners. With that said, they have made the system terrible and hugely inefficient, which of course is immoral in my eyes.
Listen, I love Walt Disney. I mean, you know, you and Scott and I are all talking about
movies.
adventure cabins, Airbnb stuff, you know, and like my biggest inspiration for what we're trying to do is like Disney making like one of a kind, something nobody's ever seen, right? Like there, you know, I certainly disagree with some of the choices they've been making lately. But there's a lot of great things from Disney, but that one like really gets under my skin. I'm an art school dropout who became an entrepreneur, and this is good for us. Let's make sure no one else can get it. That one gets under my skin.
Yeah, so I'll channel a friend of mine, Jason Sanders, IP lawyer. He said it really well. He said, "Look, the point of what's the term in copyright? The whole point of intellectual property law." In his assertion is that the government, which serves the people, should be optimizing for maximum value of intellectual property in the public domain. It's not the tightly held maximum value. It's not the highest concentration of value. It's that you should promote the generation of works of the highest value and as quickly as possible transitioning them to the public domain.
Anybody who likes at all what Brent and I are saying should go listen to Kirby Ferguson's series, Everything is a Remix, and go to the chapter on patent trolls and how like copyright laws and patents and things were like the original language when we got it in U.S. law was for the distribution of good ideas. And they're like, hey, listen, we need to let them lock it up for 20 years so they can make some money, so it incentivizes people to do it in the first place. And then...
they need to make a living so that they can go produce again.
Not you need to make one thing once and then nobody can benefit from it forever. But
well, like let me add on to your point there, and that is that the laws are strictly not intended to allow the original creator or the person who buys the intellectual property rights to extract 100% of the value from that thing. Like the goal of the laws is to give them the minimal incentive possible before it hits the public domain. It's to transfer maximum value to the public domain, not to the
creator. And listen, I don't even fault the folks who are like, wow, this has been so great for 20 years. Can I change the book a little bit so I can recopyright the new version of it or something? But it's the predatory lawsuits of like, yeah, but what about the uncopyrighted version that you're protecting and pretending that it's still copyrighted when it's clearly in the public domain or these kind of things?
Well, even more blatantly than that, right? The patent term is 20 years, right? Like people are pouring billions into pharmaceuticals for the hope of 20-year monopoly, right? And somehow we need, on copyrights, we need life of the author plus 90 years, 90? Like the guy dies and then the clock starts ticking for 90 years? Like that's an abomination.
Well, it's certainly inefficient for the spreading of good ideas. I think one of the things that tortured me in art school was, how am I going to be original? How am I going to be original? And then like we had these great art teachers from where I went to Ricks College. It was about 75% art center grads, which is kind of like the Harvard of commercial art. Okay. And like, I remember them saying like, you know, mediocre artists try to get everything out of their head. Great artists have a ton of reference materials. And to Kirby Ferguson, like they're remixing. Like, you know, Austin Kleon's book, Steal Like an Artist, or Stephen Johnson's book, Where Good Ideas Come From. Like it's like you can only create really great things when you get over the myth of originality.
Wasn't it Picasso or somebody that said, you know, good artists crib and great artists steal?
And it's like, you know, and what I love about Austin Kleon's work, he's like, bad theft is plagiarism, stealing from one person. Good theft is when you go through 100 people and you cherry pick and remix the best, and people will call you so original because they just don't know your sources, right? And, you know, you look at like hip hop, rap, you know, the number one most popular music in the world right now, whether you like it or not, okay? In those early days, with their ability to sample and so many things and recombine in genuinely novel ways was incredible. And you look at the limits on that creativity because some money-grubbing lawyer is like, oh, you know what? We can probably push our rights further. And we've got more lobbyists than that broke kid trying to become a musician. And
yeah, they're suppressing creativity and value generation in order to concentrate.
And I don't believe you should be able to like rip off somebody's song and then just call it your own. Okay. But this idea that you can't take influences and remix and do these things is just very counterproductive to growing an economy, growing a society.
It's so funny how we have a double standard when it comes to art and kind of anything else. Like if you look at like trademark law over the years, aspirin used to be a trademark name, right? And it became cultural. It just became a lowercase descriptive, you know, term for the drug, and the trademark was stripped. Similarly, I mean, patents expire very quickly, 20 years. And somehow if it's art though, like it's sacrosanct, and we have to have a different set of like value judgments that we place on it. And even if it's bad art, we're still going to protect that for the life of the author plus 90 years for good measure.
Well, listen, I hope you get a lot richer, and then I hope you get your own lobbyists and help entrepreneurs and artists who need a hand
up. Tell you what, if I'm ever actively involved in politics, it's going to be trying to pass a raft of anti-incumbent legislation.
I love it. So. Okay. Tell people either a YouTuber or an author or somebody that that you think people maybe should be checking out in their entrepreneurial journeys.
Oh, I read a bunch of books this year. My two favorites were quite different from each other. Number one is The Psychology of Money.
Okay, why? Why do you like that one? Because I have a bunch of friends that like it. But why do you like it?
He doesn't get into financial tactics. He gets into, here's how you need to think if you want to, you know, be happy with a certain degree of wealth. And it's super powerful. My other favorite book from this year is How to Be a Friend by Seneca, I think.
Oh, really? The Stoic philosopher?
Latin philosopher. So maybe it's Cicero. It's Cicero. Yeah, so How to Be a Friend. It's absolutely fantastic in two ways. One is that he is so thoughtful about the characteristics that make people compatible as friends and how you should behave, how you should carry yourself with your friends. The second is that he is clearly a kind, thoughtful human being who is trying his very best to live a moral life and bless the lives of the people around him. And as he's, you know, expounding on his philosophy, though, he gives these little peeks into Roman culture and the way that life worked back then. And it is, you know, if you're very woke at all, it's going to be horrific. Like, it is going to just, you're going to want to gouge your eyes and ears out. But understand that he is a kind, generous, well-meaning human being who simply lived 2,000 years ago in different times. And he was promoting a very progressive agenda for the time. And by today's standards, he would be terrible. Yeah, he'd absolutely be canceled. Right.
Oh, okay, I'm going to check that one out. I haven't gotten into that one. Listen, thanks for doing this. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, of course. I enjoyed it.
Bye, everyone.